playing on it.
Yeah. We bring that board for you.
Any snakes today?
No snakes today.
Hey,
how you doing?
All right.
Good.
Mandatory online
homeless. Begging for cool weather.
I was looking for you in the media somewhere.
I was selling to you. Damn, I looked, I was putting them on a pellet truck. I said, God damn. They told them six was trouble.
Damn, yeah, you told me that. You got number?
Well, they just told me today.
Today, okay.
Yeah, they said they could fix it. That
that red one, right? The new one you bought?
Yeah, that's a new Chevrolet.
Right, she wasn't 2 years old, was she?
2 years old.
2 years old,
okay. I don't like the parking. You better get to worry about the parking.
There he is. He's doing all right. Good to see you. Me too. I'll show you a couple dollars.
Don't worry about that. Well, hometown guy, bless y'all.
We're not going to let me do that for a dollar.
Oh, man, I can't.
All right,
back on up here.
I think put a rooftop unit on
there. Some nice ones in there.
He likes it. Got side door and back door, so you access it easy. You know.
Who we got there on the couch?
Load right up to sitting there.
I don't think we've quite gone live there yet.
I ain't got no young blood no more.
I have to check with Vernon then, but we tried to spread it out a little bit up there.
I'm going to say 2000. 2007, 2008, in deep water.
We haven't quite started yet. Probably another minute or so here.
All right, we'll call the SMAC meeting to order. I'd like to thank all the members for coming. Got some staff here and people from them, so anyway, without any further delay, I'll turn this over to Andrew and we'll get started on the reporting issue there.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and run over the agenda real quick, but the first part is a discussion on a transition to mandatory online harvest reporting. Adam Kenyon of VMRC was going to cover that portion of the agenda. It should be pretty quick there, and then we'll jump into the replenishment update and then the main event there of the just preliminary discussion of the 2019-2020 oyster harvest season. So I'll let Adam take it from here, and then I'll jump back up here in a couple minutes.
All right. How are you tonight? For those of you who don't know me, my name is Adam Kenyon. I run a few different programs here at VMRC. One of those programs that I oversee is a mandatory harvest reporting program, which all of you are probably pretty familiar with. I know you've got a lengthy agenda, so I only want to take maybe about 10 minutes of your time and really just plant an idea and solicit some feedback from the committee, and hopefully you guys can bring this back. And next SMAC meeting, I can get a little more information. So if you're all familiar with the mandatory online reporting program, it's a program where we report on monthly harvest on forms, on folders, and send it to VMRC for record keeping. So there's a few potential problems down the line with this program. One, it's very expensive. You can imagine between the forms, between the folders, between the postage, and all that, it gets to be very expensive. The other part of this is when we receive those folders and forms, we send them out to a data typing company. It's only one in the area, and as the digital age continues to bloom, these companies are essentially dinosaurs. The one we're currently operating with has been sold 2 times in the last 3 years during our contract. So we're really looking at trying to get in front of these companies closing down and us being in a place where do we go? Which kind of brings me to why I'm here today. And I want to, one, introduce you to the idea of online reporting and possibly migrating to this as mandatory for oysters in the upcoming future. So I say new, but online reporting, we have actually established a program back in 2009 and was available for users starting in 2010. So it's a program that's been developed for over 10 years now. A part of the problem is we don't really have buy-in from the industry. We have about 415 total register users and only about 268 harvesters total in Virginia. use our online system. So we have less than a 13% cooperation rate. We get anywhere between 20 to 30 new applicants every year. So it's not something that's booming. It's not something a lot of people are interested in. Of those, just to give you a little snapshot of Oysters, 172 individuals who did Oyster. That includes all private, all public, reported online. So it's a very small faction right now that are reporting online. So I'm here in front of you tonight to, one, plant this idea of moving towards online reporting and really solicit some input and some feedback from this committee, as well as if you could go back and talk to other people, and next time we meet, maybe we can get a little more information. One of the reasons we decided to start with Oysters is, one, it's a large user group. It would not come out altogether. But two, it's fairly easy to report. It's 8 bushels every day. It's a single gear. It's a single species. We're not talking about 4 different market grades of crabs or maybe 10 to 12 different species that you might catch in a gill net or a pout net. So it's relatively simple. It's a big chunk, so we're hoping to spearhead this forward. I don't know. I know we have. I don't know if anyone already uses online reporting, but I have some cards here for Ms. Iverson. So if you use online reporting or you know anyone that does, we would love to solicit some input from them. What's cumbersome online? What do they like? What don't they like? What could we do better? What we'd like to see? So I'm just going to leave some cards here. If you want to grab those, and if you could contact us, we'd get a lot more information just having a back and forth through phone. But I really want to open it up to you very briefly, and just if you have any thoughts or concerns right off the top of your head when you hear the terms online mandatory harsh reporting for oysters.
I was going to go to JC.
I guess I was probably one of the first ones to start doing this, actually back in 2009. I got a grant through Sea Grant to go around the state of Virginia and introduce this to all the crab fishermen, the oyster fishermen, try to get people to transition over from the paper, reporting to using the computer or the cell phone. So I've been doing it since then, and I really like it. I think it's much faster than doing the paper. You know, most everybody has a cell phone. I don't use my cell phone for it. I use my home computer, and I just sit down once a month. And the first day that you do it takes a little bit of time because you have to fill out all the information for the first day. But when you go to the second day, the only thing you have to put down, if you stay on the same rock and you catch 8 bushels of oysters, you put 8 bushels of oysters in the date and click the submit button and go to the next day. That's all you have to do.
And we're hoping that because of the nature of oysters, it would be a little bit easier.
It is. It is. Now, crabbing, fishing, you got a lot of different species. You know, if you got 4, you're catching twos, you're catching white crabs, you're catching sooks, you're catching jimmies, you know. It's a little more in that, you know. But it's still a lot less than doing it by paper, I think.
And it is available on your smartphone. It's available on your tablet. It's available on your desktop, your laptop, whatever electronic device you have that can get online. It's available through that format.
A lot of people, still aren't that computer savvy, and it's not a hard program to learn. I can come over and help your wife or something. You know, it's really very simple. Once you get your password and you're logged into the fisheries statistics system, just a matter of clicking on it and opening it up and just doing that first fill out on it. You know, and it's very easy. I really like it.
And our implementation goal is October 2020 to do it for oysters. We do have a plan to have technicians available out in the field, have an established schedule that we could visit the local law enforcement, and you would know someone would be there this day on every month, that you could bring stuff there and they could teach you to go through.
Yeah.
We have a great staff. They're always available on the phone, and you can always come here in the office and we can help. So those are kind of details that we want to get out in front of and solicit some information.
I've done a bunch of outreach sessions. I went to Tangier, I went to Reedville, I went to Kilmarnock, I went to Pocosin, I went to a lot of different places just to try to get everybody on board with it, you know. And we did I think total, I think when you talk about crabbing and fishing and oystering, I think we are up probably 30% to 40%, you know, as far as people doing the reporting, you know.
And we started out really hot and heavy. 2013, we had 164 people.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we're up to 415, but over the last 3-4 years, it's only been about 20, 30 people. So
yeah.
There is some reluctance to change.
Yeah, right,
it is something
right,
new,
yeah.
It is something different.
Well, I can understand.
It's a lot easier.
Yeah, it is. Now, some places still don't have good, you know, internet capabilities, you know.
Well, we do all of our oyster training online.
Yep.
So at some point, everyone had to have access to online to do their oyster training. So we've already kind of broken down that wall a little bit, but
mm-hmm.
we can make this available at our satellite offices or here in the office as well.
Mm-hmm.
I just wish you would give us till 10. Started all them threatening emails.
I'm sorry I'm late, but we were on Interstate 64 backed up.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if this question is redundant or not, but is this strictly just for the public? Does it doesn't include the private?
No, the numbers I'm giving you includes public and private, but really we'd like to move all oysters public and private.
The question then
all
is, on a private, what I'm permitted to do is to lump everything that we do on a monthly basis.
Correct.
And make it one.
Mm-hmm.
And I just make the report and send it at the end of the month.
Yep.
So
and that's still available online for.
Okay.
For
all right. Okay. Thank you.
So again, I only want to take 10 minutes of time and kind of float that idea. You'll see me again at other FMAC meetings. If you guys have any feedback, I left Stephanie's cards here. You can contact me. Please go out, solicit some thoughts, solicit some concerns. The more we kind of get this out in the open, we can try and come up with a plan to try and help some of those concerns before it comes in.
Would you see the ability of some of these guys to come into an office? What sort of period of time do you see as far as when you would say, okay, you're on your own?
So, I mean, we again, preliminary stages, we've talked about having someone in each satellite office, we'll say the last Thursday of every month or the first Tuesday of every month, so that they're there. And as long as people keep showing up and we feel that it is an effective, it's a good tool, we're going to keep going. As soon as I start sending someone and there be 3, 4, 5 months and no one shows up or one person shows up, it might not be cost effective to really send someone out. But as long as people are using the resource and as long as it's helpful, you know, we can have people available to try and help through that, because those same people won't have to be coding folders, they won't have to be processing folders. Their job, what they can do, can transition to actually kind of some online help and tutorials.
I know through our office we've probably got 7 or 8. I had one there this past Monday asking, could someone help them with they had to redo their online certification for shellfish safety. And we do see a number of particularly the older watermen that, number one, don't have internet at home, and two, are just terrified of a computer.
Yeah, we understand that.
Unfortunately, the attrition of that, one of the particular guys that was in my office is in excess of 80 years old. So, you know, that's, we're going to move away from that, albeit we would like to see it. Obviously, it's going to happen. But I do think there's probably a 10 or 15% sector of the watermen there that it's just impossible to think they're going to be able to do this strictly on their own.
And that's why this feedback and transition plan will be really important, because this will be the first species that we try and tackle, because
okay.
It's the simplest.
And I would recommend, you know, point them to their buyers. I mean, we try to work with all of theirs. We got some younger tech-savvy people and try to help them with it, but I think that might be one resource to help some of these folks, is push them towards, you know, obviously someone's got, you know, they can help them, so.
One suggestion, if y'all could sit down, and we used to have a tutorial that would very easily explain.
There's one online already.
Okay.
If you
right,
click,
right.
Hey, you can go online,
okay.
You can click commercial reporting,
mm-hmm.
online reporting, and you can say sign up, and there's a little tutorial that walks you through it right there.
Every step by step.
Online,
mm-hmm.
So you can actually do that tonight when you go home. I don't want to take up too much of your time. It's really just floating an idea, but you will see me back. If you have any questions, you can always call me. If you have some feedback on the operating system, you can contact Ms. Iverson. And thank you guys very much.
All right, thank you. I guess we'll move on now to the OSHA replenishment update.
Yeah, I guess we should kind of skip to Deb. We had some more folks show up. Go ahead and get introductions for the recording and record of everybody who's here. So.
All right. Okay. State your name and where you're from. We'll start down here.
John DeMaria, Fort News.
Beverly Lafford, Virginia Beach.
Ernie George, Whitestone, Virginia.
J.C. Hudgens, Matthews.
Wayne France, Northern Neck.
Kathy Shannon, Chesapeake.
Tom Porter, Sciences.
Cody Metcalf, Parsley.
Richard Hardy in Reedville.
Tommy Kellum, Weems.
I think we got Dan on the phone there.
Yeah.
Yep, Dan. Dan Dice, Tangier there, so. Andrew,
I can't hear real good, Andrew.
Let me move you up here on the lectern a little bit. Is that any better?
I can hear you, Colin. I can't hear the other ones.
Okay. We can try turning their mics up a little bit there.
How's that? Are we a little closer to the mic? Is that better, Dan?
I think I heard somebody say something to me.
We'll see if it gets any better there. I think Jamie's got the mics turned up there. But if you got any questions, just chime in there, and we'll try to paraphrase what's going on for you. All right. So I'll just go over what we've been up to this summer for the most part in spring. We're about three barges away right now from completing most of the shell planting in Virginia waters. So we've done, when all of that's said and done, we'll have planted about 604,000 bushels of reef or fossil shells, 59,200 bushels of house shells. We've also been talking about a little bit before the meeting the alternative substrate that we've been planting for restoration non-harvest areas in the Pianca tank. We'll be able to take what we learned from that process and potentially use some of that in future replenishment efforts in harvest areas. But this has been the largest scale alternative substrate plant this year. We've done close, when all things are said and done, about 60 acres of alternative substrate stone planting there. That's going to be about 18,000 tons or so of stone planted there. So that's what we've been doing in terms of replenishment. And also this spring, the background there of that agenda is the seed that we were moving this spring from the shell plant that we did on the Nansman Ridge the last 2 years in a row. So in total, we've moved 7,985 bushels of that has gone to areas in Rappahannock, Smoky Point, Moratico, and Hog House. Got some of that seed right there. The Comico, we did about 2,000 bushels there, so we got two good loads up there. And then Pocomoke, Area 13, Shell Rock, got around 4,000 bushels in that H2, H3, and H4, so sort of spread out in three areas there. So we were hopeful that we might be able to get a little bit more seeded out of those areas, closer to 20,000 bushels. But once we started getting down into not that good fluffy high count seed, we didn't want to be paying to move less than that and really grind up that area. So we're going to replant that area again this year and sort of try to grow that as a seed area for future replenishment effort and sort of keep this program going. And everything that we did see this spring, we rechecked the areas that we planted in the Cone River there, and those areas looked like they had good growth even with the low salinity. So the two bars that we planted there looked like they were shaping up for not this year, but next year to open up and be a pretty productive, good little boost there. So that sort of shared the wealth that we saw in that really good spat set we got in the lower James to some other areas that haven't had great spat sets here recently.
Andrew, how are the other areas, the previous substrate, previous planting with the stone alternate substrate?
Some of the areas that we planted last year in the Pianca tank didn't get a great spat set just because there was almost a non-existent spat set in those areas of the Pianca tank. A lot of the areas that we've done in the Rappahannock and the Pianca tank in earlier years have worked very well, as good, if not better, than oyster shell in terms of spat density there. So that area in the lower Rappahannock was opened up 2016 in Area 1 there. It had, that was a stone plant. I think some of those oysters came through there. They were a little bit snappy, but I think that they definitely work in those areas where you do plant there. I think as that area's worked, probably they should improve in terms of a good area for, once they've been broken up a little bit there. So yeah, it works well if you get a good set, but not so much if you don't. So.
And another question, I think I had here. I know next year if you plant a tributary on the Thumbcut, it lines up to be the nomina.
Mm-hmm.
But if salinity levels still stay low in the tribs of the Potomac, where would you go or what would you do?
I think in that case there are some other areas in the nomina or in the Yakamako and the cone that we didn't plant, so there are some other seed areas there. We haven't checked what we do have in the nomini, but I think there has been, sort of anecdotally, some higher levels of mortality there, but it's sort of right on the edge. So we might not put a whole load up there, but maybe try a little bit. But I know it is one of those areas that does grow a quality oyster when they live. So,
Andrew, what makes a snappy oyster? I mean, is that a particular species, or just the way your wag grows, or I mean, why is it just one little place you'll get a few
too thick?
No,
mostly high density there, and if they're close together, they're growing towards. They're like house plants almost.
Okay.
They grow towards the nutrients.
So
if they're
okay.
close, or if they're in sediment, or they're trying to grow up as opposed to out.
Okay.
And it can be
like a head of lettuce when they come up.
I mean, they're growing towards water flow, too.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you've seen, like, cage aquaculture oysters, if they're jammed in there or one that's buried in the mud, that bill shoots off to the side. So they're just, instead of growing towards the light, they're growing towards food.
Okay.
Are there any other questions on replenishment this year? Okay. So, just in case... No one has, probably not many folks have been out to the actual fossil shell dredge, but this is just a quick video of what that operation looks like. So. It's actually pretty loud, but this is, I'm kind of following the path the shell takes, so it comes up that tube there, the hydraulic dredge, drops into the top of this washer and sorter here. It's falling down. This is a shaker screen, so all the large oyster shells are getting sorted out. All the smaller fine shells are dropping to the bottom, further sorting there, and they're going over to the barge over on this side. So it's a pretty unique piece of equipment out there working.
Looks like an Alaskan gold mining operation.
Yeah.
Identical.
So that's where a fossil shell comes from, or a reef shell.
So the larger shell you use to put on to replenish oyster grounds that are getting depleted of substrate. What do you do with the fine stuff?
The fine stuff, we get a credit for a certain amount of that. So it's almost cinders, ash like that, and they'll buy a certain amount of that for the state, and we get a credit on that we turn back into more large shells usually. So a portion of that they'll buy about maybe 10,000 yards or so, and then the rest of it goes back into the dredge cut there at the bottom.
And the supply of fossil shells we're working on right now, how long is that projected to last?
The best estimates are about 15 to 25 years is sort of the currently known sources there. So it is something to consider as we look forward into future seasons, that it is, regardless of if new sources are found, price could make it prohibitive eventually too. But probably in 15 to 25 years, somewhere in that ballpark range, the known areas that we're working are going to be not easily able to get that, produce that same number of shells. So it is something to consider as we go forward in this season and in future seasons.
What's the maximum size of that pine shell?
It's almost everything that's over an inch and a quarter, I believe, is kept. So everything smaller than that should be...
inch and a quarter or smaller?
Yeah.
What happens with the vines?
They purchase a portion of those, the company that we contract with, and I've heard anecdotally that some of them end up as actually high-end pigeon food, but a portion of them have been used in the past for building, sort of, when we used to do some of the 3D reef projects, we've used them as that, as base, and the majority of them that aren't actually being purchased are going back into the dredge cut that's made there, so.
Duration, you have just
guesstimate? It can vary from area to area, but it's probably about 20% or so fines, give or take. Sometimes it can be higher or lower depending on the seam that they're working in. But I think roughly about that.
Is there another deposit in Tangier Pocomoke sound area?
There have been some other map deposits in those areas. They have been hydraulically dredged before. There's also some other areas in Tribal Shoals and the Upper James that still have shell where this operation used to work. The other deposits, a lot of the other known deposits are in Maryland there. There are some other deposits in the Elizabeth River area that are mapped, so there are a number of other areas that still have these reef deposits, but the only two permitted sites in Virginia are the one we're working on now in the Tribal Shoals area.
Where are you working at now?
Off Hampton Road there, just on the Hampton Road side of Nansman Ridge.
You can see it right off the Monitor Merrimack right now. And one more question. Is there a difference that you see between the house and fossil shells in terms of sap set generally?
I can jump to some slides there, but no, it really depends on year to year and area by area. This is actually just a graph of mean spat fall just in area one of house shell versus, or this is just fossil shell here, this slide. So you can see that in some areas it performs very well, spat per square meter. Again, this is house shell and fossil shell, so it really is area specific and year specific. But there haven't been any issues when the spat are there, whether it's house or fossil shell. More concrete, as long as it's in the right area at the right time.
What you've been getting off Nansman Ridge to plant the trips of the Potomac and the upper Rappahannock stuff, most of that has been fossil shell, strike on fossil shell?
All of that's from the last 2 years of reef shell or fossil shell planting that we've done.
And it's been a pretty good strike.
Yeah, that was that background image there of this... That's the reef shell that we're planting. So you can see there's spat on top of spat on top of spat. So it performs. I mean, house shell works great, and so does reef shell. Area dependent. And like all shells, I mean, there are seams where the shell isn't quite as thick as in terms of the actual thickness of the individual shell. So there might be a seam where the shell might be a little thinner. It's like you might get a batch of shucked oysters where the shell is going to be a little bit thinner. So there is some variation between the actual shell, but in terms of the type of shell, we haven't seen any difference on large-scale planting.
Have you checked 9 and 10?
We haven't checked those yet this year. We didn't get much of a set there last year, but they did get some shell. So there were some spat there, but we'll sort of have a better idea after this year what it looks like. And I'll go over numbers in the Pocomoke when we get into the season there. Are there any other, before we roll into our preliminary discussion of harvest season there, any other questions? Okay. So I'm just going to go over some sort of background information there, and I'll pause a couple times if there's any questions, and then we'll sort of, if it's agreeable to the committee, open it up for discussion after we go through some background information. This is the updated harvest graph for the 2018-2019 season. A little caveat there on the private ground production. The harvest seasons run from July to the following June, and there's usually a little bit of a lag in the mandatory reporting, which will be helped out when everyone goes to online reporting. We'll have that data more up to date than the folder method that we're working with now. So this number for the private ground will likely shift upwards, but it does look like both the public ground production and the private ground production have decreased to, we're right at about the lowest five-year average, so we're still above our sort of running 10-year average. Probably this is primarily because of the increased mortality that we saw and the stunted growth rates from the fresh water that we've seen. So as you can see, in most years, the private and public tend to track together. So this was somewhat anticipated that we'd kind of be where we are here. So not a drastic fall off in the harvest numbers, but a dip from where we have been over the last 5 years. And that's something to think about as we go forward, that probably we're still going to be seeing in this coming season a little bit of the carryover effects of that that freshwater mortality that we saw last year in some of the harvest areas, as well as the spat set not being particularly widespread. And we almost, I wouldn't say completely lost a year of growth, but some of those areas that have our slower growing oysters, particularly in the already low salinity areas, they might not have got that two full years of growth that they normally get between a three-year rotation there. So just something to keep in mind as we go forward, that we may be seeing that this season again.
Andrew?
Yeah.
Is the private bushel, does that include cage oysters?
Yep. So that private ground number includes all of the production off private ground. So both the traditional, which is this 34%, so that's your stuff that's caught with dredges, scrapes, mostly dredges and scrapes. About 24% of that private ground number, this is just a 2017 calendar year sort of a snapshot, is coming from containerized cages. And then this is your percent of that annual harvest that's coming from purely public ground traditional methods. So if you look at it, these two pieces together are really sort of a traditional fishery with traditional gear, primarily based on shell planting and natural spat set. There's some spat on shell that's in captured in this portion, so the hatchery produced spat on shell, but that's dependent a lot of times on wild oyster shells to build the base and catch the spat that you're then planting on. But this 24% is what we know is predominantly hatchery based, so that's your clutchless oyster seed right there. That's sort of just a snapshot of a calendar year. And this 24% has come up a little bit. It was closer to 20% in 2016, so that has been inching upwards, but we're still pretty much primarily a traditional fishery for the majority of our oysters in the state right now. And that's part of the reason why you see those harvest public and private numbers tend to track so well together, is they're generally dependent on that natural spat set in previous years in the shell.
Andrew, didn't we have a couple years, I mean 3 or 4 years back, didn't we do over 600,000 bushels total in I didn't see those kind of numbers on there.
These are combined. So if you combine these two together, so before had these graphs sort of stacked together, and I kind of broke this out so they're side by side, so you can kind of compare.
Okay, I'm looking at the total on the side over here.
Yeah, so like right here, that's where we were up over 600,000.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a different graph, but I thought it gave a little bit better breakdown.
Okay.
On a sort of side-by-side comparison. So our total numbers this year are, not quite, just a little bit under 500,000 there, mm-hmm. but they have been up over 600,000, I think 640,000.
The last 4 or 5 years, really, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
I
guess I kind of question, I guess it would be for you or Mr. Callum or Mr. Coward. Do you think, or are we looking at, I don't know about the public fishery, but the private fishery, are looking at another maybe decline this year after the conditions we had in the past year?
Sure.
In our case, it's not so much death as just slow growth, and right now we're working on oysters that we should have been working on in September. We're jumping ahead so rapidly that, you know, we're just leaving so much small stuff behind. I hope it hadn't run it to the point it's not going, but we are seeing good growth in the last 6 weeks, so hopefully it'll catch back up. But yeah, it's definitely going to affect our harvest number.
And did you have anything you wanted to
add? I think Tommy summed it up pretty well.
And this is just sort of anecdotal, and I think there are probably folks with large shell piles, and I keep an eye on shell piles and where most of the shells are going. I do my best to sort of be aware of that. And I would suspect that a lot of the private ground harvest that has been happening in the last sort of since 2014, when a lot of people were sort of jumping back into it, I can't speak for everybody, but I would suspect that private ground hasn't been seeing a level of shelling that it probably needs to remain at the production that it has been. So I suspect there are some areas that have been dredged probably and haven't had shell planted back, so those areas aren't going to continue to produce. And that's, I can't say that definitively, but that's sort of more anecdotally what I've been sort of hearing and seeing throughout the state. So I would suspect that, you know, I don't think there'll be a huge resurgence in that private ground number, but hopefully it doesn't dip considerably more. So that was that public-private breakdown, and this number is one of those things that can continue to grow, but I don't think it's going to suddenly jump to fill in that 34% of that hatchery-produced stuff. I mean, anyone who's... Go ahead.
That 24%, is that based on any kind of mandatory number, or is that just that at-will voluntary program that VIMS does?
This is based on our mandatory harvest reporting system. So that 24% is based on gear type. So when you're reporting your harvest, you have to report whether you caught it with a dredge, or on aquaculture cases, you're reporting it in bottom cages, floats, bags.
Whatever.
So I catch it that way.
So they're all BMRC numbers.
Yeah. So that's where I don't include the sort of spat on shell reporting from that voluntary one, but you can sort of add 40 to 60,000 bushels maybe to the traditional harvest on that, but that's self-reporting. We don't capture whether it actually really is hatchery produced in our system, just the gear that it's, but I don't think, yep.
So that 42% public, that's hand tong, that's scrape, that's patent tong, everything.
Yeah. And that's the same for basically any of those non-containerized, any of those traditional gear types are this 34% too.
Okay.
So. This is just a sort of a combined breakdown of the last three calendar years of where the public harvest is coming from. So this large blue portion is the oyster scrape or hand scrape. So 63% of the public harvest is coming from the scrape fishery. The next biggest piece of the pie, if you will, is actually hand tongs. So this is primarily the James River there, but 21% of the public ground oysters have been coming from hand tong areas. So those are folks who are, there's a lot of people who are basically stay hand tonging from October all the way through the season there, and they're producing a pretty good chunk of the market harvest there. Oyster dredge is the next piece there, so 12%. This is last three years combined. By hand, which is really only on the seaside, but there's only really a handful of people working out there. There are a lot of oysters on the seaside of the Eastern Shore, but you got to get out of your boat to get them. So there's not many people over there who are still doing it. There's a few older folks and a few younger folks in Oyster and Chincoteague and Wachapreek who are still going out, but they're mostly catching a couple bags of oysters, not 6-8 bushels, but they're getting a little day's work out of that. Pat and Tongs, this doesn't include the numbers from this total recent season, but that's been about 3%. I suspect this number is going to jump up a little bit here in the future, but this is, again, the last 3 years combined. This is the licenses sold in 2018, so this is sort of the number of people who at least intended to participate by gear. Again, Hand Scrape, Hand Tong, Dredge, and Pat Tong. This is the total number of user fees there. I believe you asked Tony last time for a little more breakdown on that. And of the 900 folks who purchased that All Gear user fee last year, 466 reported some harvest, and of those reporting harvest, 427 had their 40 days. So there's still a lot of latent effort there, but the majority of participants are getting their 40 days there, only 427, or only that difference there about had less than the 40 days. So most of the people who are fishing are full-time. This is sort of going back historically. You may have seen different iterations of this, but this line right here, I know it's kind of a busy graph, is the number of bushels of harvest right there. So you can see back in 1980, we were harvesting, you know, similar numbers to where we were in sort of the peak in 2014 here, close to over 600,000 bushels of oysters. But you can see Hat and Tongs and was the dominant gear type all the way through sort of the decline there in the early 90s. So the number of dredges has stayed about the same. It's the same folks out there on Tangier mainly and who are in those dredge areas. So the dredge fishery really has been pretty stable for this time period. But what's happened as we opened up more areas in the Rappahannock and other areas that had never been dredged before, we transitioned those areas over to Hand Scrape. So you can see you know, the number of participants, which is over here, has come back up, but the gear has transitioned over to the Hand Scrape, which is a more efficient gear. So we've gotten the harvest numbers up to where they were before, with actually less people, actually lower harvest numbers participating with the same more efficient gear. So you can see that there was actually more harvest being taken earlier with less efficient gear than we have now. So that's just to say that the scrape fishery, if the oysters are there, you can catch more oysters with different gear than you can with the same number of participants using that more efficient gear. I might have confused folks there a little bit, but I know that's kind of a busy graphic.
Well, one thing that confused me is back in the day of Pat Tong, there were no limits on what you could get.
Right. Yeah. It is a little bit of an unfair comparison if there are limits there, but it's just to show that you know that there has been this transition primarily to a different gear type.
And I think back then we just had more density of oysters on those particular grounds, you know. And I mean, naturally, you go in with a scrape, you're going to do a whole lot better on scattered oysters than you will with Pat Tong. That's for sure.
There was a lot of
oysters
back in the early
90s.
And I guess this doesn't take into account all the Hand Tong areas there, but this sort of just shows you the long-term trends with the dominant gear types and harvest numbers. But the oyster tong, ordinary Hand Tong, has been a sort of unsung workhorse for a long time in the oyster fishery, even going back then. I think, Don, you were telling me that area 9 and 10 there used to catch 40 bushels of market oysters in a day Hand Tong. Yeah. It'd be good if there were 12 there you could catch, but Hand Tongs now, huh?
That's like in the 80s, we were allowed 15 bushels per man. That's 45 bushels per boat, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a big difference now.
Are there any other questions on sort of the harvest numbers there? I was going to go by area now and sort of show you based mostly on the 2018 stock assessment. Are there any questions on harvest numbers before we move on?
I have a question, Andrew. How many licenses were in Pat and Tom's you had? I didn't catch that.
133.
Yeah, 133. And this number has gone up. I think 3 or 4 years ago there was about 30 or 40 licenses sold. It jumped up to, I believe, 105 in 2017. This is the highest number of Pat Tong licenses I think we've seen in a number of years there. So now I'm going to run through the areas that would be set to open in sort of the normal rotation if we didn't change anything. So the areas that would be open to scraping and dredging in our normal 3 and 2 year rotation. I'll sort of go over those numbers and then we can start our discussion on sort of how last season went, how we want this season to go, and sort of the shared concerns we have about going forward with what we've seen with that spat set in 2018 and then mortality. And also, I mean, the other issues going on in the oyster market in terms of availability of oysters generally. Sort of the Gulf oyster there, my understanding is they've had some more rain there recently, so there's going to be demand for oysters now, and I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon, which is good, but it is a finite amount that we have here in Virginia, and I don't think we can support the whole country, but anyway, we'll get into that there. So, area one here in the Rappahannock and Pocomoke is scheduled to open up this season. Blackberry Hangs hasn't been in a rotation before. The upper portion of the Great Wicomico there, area one there. Rappahannock area four here, Drummond Ground area, and the lower area two. So I'll sort of go over those numbers and we'll move down to the lower bay a little bit. So again, I changed the graphs a little bit. You're used to seeing those stacked graphs where market and small are combined, but I thought this would be sort of an easier comparison. So the gray here is the density of market oysters, orange the density of small oysters, and blue is the density of spat. So the 2017 season, this was the last time this area was opened. So you can see that we've actually, the last time it was open, we actually have recovered in terms of the number of market oysters there slightly. So not a huge increase in Tangier, Pocomoke, Area 1, but there are going to be a few more market oysters per square meter than there have been in recent years in this area. Long-term trends, I mean, you go back to 2009 and there were even more, and we're talking 5 per square meter, which isn't huge, but on a large area like that, it is a little bit of an increase there in Tangier Area 1. And we did get a little bit more spat set in 2018. This is one of the few areas where we did see spat set. The salinity stays a little higher over there, so not as high as it has been in some years, but higher than it was in 2017 and 2015, but again, lower than we saw in 2016, which is really the spat set that we're going to be working on this year. So you can see this spat set translates to this bump in market oysters there. So area two in the Rappahannock, again, same color coding. You can see that we did get a very good spat set in 2015, and you can see that this was right before it was open there, that post-harvest. This was the last time prior to 2016. That was when this area was last open. So you can see we've actually recovered there. So the level of markets in Area 2 in the Rappahannock anyway is going to be, it's recovered since the last time it was opened up. So they primarily, because of this good spat set in 2015, we should be sort of seeing that come into the market areas there. But again, you can see that we've really had 3 years of sort of mediocre spat sets there. We haven't seen a good pulse like that again, which is what we're going to be working on now. So after this harvest, we're going to be sort of back down at these levels again in this area. So we're up close to 10 markets per square meter in Area 2, which is high enough in this area that's close to the densities you get in parts of Deep Rock, which is a Patentong area there where people were able to work for 3 months. So overall, Area 2 in the Rappahannock is getting up to a level where it could support, you know, a Patentong fishery in some spots in that area. or it would be a very good scrape season, and potentially next year, since we haven't had a spat set to work on 2-3 years from the road, we could see what it would be based on spat sets. But if we harvest it now, it's not going to recover again to these levels until we get another good spat set in those areas, is the most likely thing that we'd see in Area 2. Area 4 is similar to Area 5 last year. So you can see that in 2015, this was the last time that area was, this is a survey right before it was opened in 2016. So this gray bar here is much higher, about twice as high, the density of oysters there. So close, it was up close to eight oysters per square meter. Now it's right around 4 there. So about half the market oyster density as to when it was last open for harvest. So 2016, you can see that's when that harvest happened and it dropped off. But this is similar to what the market oysters looked like in Area 5 last year. So this was Area 5. And you can see this was the number of markets right before that 2018 season. And everybody was somewhat expecting it to be as good as it was here prior to the opening, where it was almost twice as high as it was when it was opened up. So you can kind of see that the expectations that it will be good as the last time it'll open are probably going to be similar in Area 4. That combined with, I mean, there doesn't look like, knock on wood, we've had the same levels of stunted growth and freshwater mortality there, but I suspect some of the deeper oysters may have, you know, succumbed as the other areas did last year there that we saw. So I would suspect that Area 2 is going to be similar to Area 3, and that it'll hold some boats there and be pretty productive. But most of Area 5, with a few exceptions, is going to be a little bit worse than it was the last time it was opened up. And by a little bit, 20-30% or so, which can translate to that much less effort, which is sort of what the problem was with Area 5 in the Rappahannock last year. Again, this is a deep rock patentong area, so you can see the standing stocks. We haven't resurveyed that area since the increase in effort that we saw this year, but this area has been getting minimal replenishment, and the standing stocks have been generally tracking upwards there. So we'll jump down to the York River. So Area 2 in the York is scheduled to open this year. This is the area just above the bridge, Timberneck. So from Pages down to Timberneck, Pages in Aberdeen would come online next year in the rotation. And the James areas would stay the same as they have been in recent years. Again, the story is sort of similar in the York River. You can see, so the last time it came around in the rotation prior to being open, that spat sets were, or the market level was a little bit higher. It has somewhat recovered there, but it's not probably going to be quite as, maybe a little bit better actually there than it has been recently in Area 1. But Area 2 over here, you can see this was prior to the last opening. It actually has come down there a little bit. So Area 2 won't have recovered the level it was the last time it was opened. But Area 1 is something to look forward to potentially for next year. And again, you can see that we're working on good spat sets in 2015 and 2016, whereas again, the spat sets were low and very low last year. So after this rotation, after these areas are open up to harvest, it's going to be 2-3 years before these areas are able to rebound if they get a good spat set this year.
So you're opening Area 1 or Area 2?
Area 2 here.
Area 2. I thought it was backwards.
Yeah. Area 2 below, just above the bridge.
Yeah.
But this is just sort of a comparison by the two areas there.
How about Mobjack?
Mobjack isn't going to be open this year, but that area, it's been pretty stable here recently, so it hasn't really gone up or down a great deal. So, but it hasn't been phenomenal there either, and it's been slow growing.
Based on what we see here, would it make sense to flip-flop? I know it's a rotation on paper, but if you were to look scientifically from this information, it would seem that it would make more sense to trade areas to give two more time to come up and more standing stock in one.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like it's less smalls in one than it is in two.
Well, I guess that it's one of those, you want them, that sort of sets you up potentially for a worse situation for next year. So this is one of the areas where the rotation is going to work out, where this area is still going to be halfway decent next year, whereas the other areas may not be. So it is a thought there, but
I'm not necessarily thinking for more resource this year. I'm thinking for just giving that more time to shift to the right, to the gray.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess it's there are a few more smalls there, but it's not really a huge difference between the areas, really. I mean, you're looking at 12 smalls there versus 8 or 9, so it's not not like we've seen where there's been a giant sort of spat set where we wouldn't want to grind it up. So it's sort of a marginal difference, enough to probably make for a better season in Area 1 this year than Area 2. But I don't think the sort of resource damage would necessarily warrant a change. It would be a shift that would probably be relatively neutral, but it may put, if there are other areas that aren't as good next year, then Area 1 is one of those areas that could be sort of a good thing going for next year. But it is something that we could consider.
So when was the last time these areas were worked?
Yeah. When was 2? That was what, 15 or 16?
Area 2 was 15-16 season there.
Yeah.
So the same as 2 and 4.
We skipped a year on the rotation on it because it wasn't that good.
Mm-hmm.
And even though, you know, it hasn't been worked since then, we see a steady decline in the large oysters.
Well, I mean, that is, it could be related to a number of things, but you do see that there has been a little bit of a decline there, but not yet to the levels of prior to it being open to harvest there. So this survey was probably taken right before it was actually harvested. So that's why you're seeing that sort of jump there. So the timing of it sometimes works out where the survey takes place pre or post-harvest, so you can kind of track that. But this rotation is with the mobjack. So 1 and 2 and the mobjack are on the same rotation schedule. So when the York is closed, the mobjack has been open. So it's been a 3-year rotation here, with the mobjack being on the off year when both the areas in New York have been closed. I didn't put a graph up there, the Great Wicomico, but that area is very similar to where it will be the last time it came around that rotation. So not a huge boost there, but that sort of stable levels there in the Great Wicomico. And Blackberry, again, that actually prior to the harvest last year, 2018, had market densities of 20 markets per square meter, so that was a very productive area. We haven't resurveyed it since there were 60 or so boats out there working on it, but we did some replenishment there this year. We planted close to 11,000 cubic yards there, or 1,100 cubic yards, so it got a little bump of shell this year. So there's that. This is the lower James, so this is the hand scrape areas in the James. Again, you can see that we have come down a little bit since 2017, but still sort of looking on a little bit of a long-term range. We're in pretty good shape. I do have some resurvey numbers for some areas there that I'll go over in a little bit. So there are some areas in the James that have come down that we resurveyed in the spring, but we haven't yet done a full resurvey of the entire James River. But there was definitely some declines in market and small oysters that we saw in some of the areas that had some of that focused effort, both in the beginning of the season last year and towards the end when there were a lot of boats piled up there as other areas weren't online. So this is the Hantong areas in the James, and you can see that total small bushels and market size, we're still much higher than we have been in recent years. But we're actually, in terms of the level of market oysters in these areas, this is in part due to some of that freshwater mortality. The number of market oysters standing stock in the Hantong areas and seed areas is lower than it has been in some time there in the James. But it's one of those areas that, because they're Hantong areas and the way that we've changed our seed quota management system, that if you do get a good spat set, they can recover relatively quickly. But it is, there are some pockets of concern in there that do have that focused seed remover, that removal that we addressed with our ability last year to close out-of-state seed transfer when we do start to see that impact. So it's something that we're going to continue to keep a close eye on this year. These are some pre- and post-harvest numbers just for the James. So you can see the ones on the left here are fall of 2018 numbers, and the ones on the right here are spring. This is Ballard's Marsh area there, and you can see spat here was up at close to 200 spat per square meter, dropped down to less than 50. Number of smalls took a little less of a hit, but the number of markets there, which was pretty good, decreased by half there. So basically, in most of these harvest areas, you see a really large drop in small and fat just from the harvest effort of scrapes and dredges, and that's really just to get about 50% or so of the market oysters. White Shoal, which was an area that was open latest last year there and closest to on the Hampton Road side of the river, we resurveyed that after this year, and you can see the number of spat went from, you know, close to 500 per square meter down considerably there. Another thing that's a little bit concerning is the level of small oysters there was up at 75 per square meter, and a lot of those small oysters left with the market oysters there last year. So you can see these are sub-market, sub-3-inch oysters, and we went from 75 per square meter to, you know, 20 or so. So a lot of little oysters left White Shoals, along with a lot of the shell there. But we did get the chance to have a light barge that was shallow draft and got a little bit of shell planted this year on White Shoal to give it a little bit of a boost after the grind that it got there this year. These are the seed areas. Point of Shoals was one of those areas of concern, and actually we saw a little bit of an increase in the number of small and fat. There was probably a late set, and it might have been a little bit of variation in the survey, but the number of markets came down. But Day's Point was one of those areas that should be going in the other direction there, and you can see that this is one of those areas where we did see some of that focused seed removal, and the number of market oysters dropped significantly there, substantially, as well as all the other size classes. This is the season from last year that we had a little bit of a back and forth on that one. You may recall we had one season established there at the August Commission meeting that we'd all agreed to, and then folks started working in October in the Rappahannock, and there was some shifts in effort as boats left Area 5, switched to the James. We made some adjustments with dates there and ended up with, this is sort of the finalized season after we had some emergency amendments there. But we'd had those areas, the James stretched from October to January, and we had a hand scrape and dredge season that ran from October to February. And there were some concerns, particularly in February, with the number of boats in these areas. I've heard from many harvesters, and we've seen it in some of the post surveys of the level of effort that was focused in these areas, particularly in January in the James, and Mobjack and Great Wicomico, Blackberry, the number of boats that were working there without the James or the Rappahannock being available to spread some of that fleet out. Those areas took a little bit of a hit last year, and we'll probably see those reflected in this coming season. So when we're working towards this season this year, it's something to sort of consider is that a lot of these areas that effort got shifted to aren't going to have recovered yet to where they were. So that effort is either going to need to not be there, or it's just going to hurt that resource more.
So it's something to consider as we look at length of season, times of when we can open it, to sort of try to distribute that effort to basically benefit the oyster fishery as a whole, not just one area or one month, but try to look at it for the whole oyster fishery, not just the people, but the resource, and try to do our best to look at not just this season, but how this season will affect next year, since, and the year after that, and probably 2 or 3 years until, if we're lucky, we get a good bat set in one of those years, and we'll sort of start to see that resource recover. So that's something to consider as we go forward in discussing this season, is how we want to address that. And I will note that I believe Rob could jump in here if I'm saying anything incorrect, but in terms of October, November, I believe that the folks who are crabbing, that bushel limits are staying the same.
November bushel limits are changing.
Okay.
Matching October's.
So that's just something to sort of keep in the back of the mind as you're considering Fulton water, and that those crab bushel limits are going to be the same in October as November. It has been, from what I understand, a good year so far for crabs. I guess 4th of July came and the market's fallen out a little bit, but that's something to consider as we talk about October and November, and then conversely February, in terms of where and when we have these seasons.
Yeah, we're in the middle of July now. I guess we're going to have to come up with something by the end of August.
Yeah, I'd like to try to get another meeting probably that second week in August, to try to reach as much consensus as we can on a season. But I try to like to get the ball rolling as much as we can here in the rest of this meeting on your thoughts and concerns based on last year and where we'd like to go this year.
Almost every year,
yeah.
You guys come up with an assortment of options for us to go over. Have you come up with anything yet? Or
I can throw up just, I have one option that I've been kind of playing around with a little bit. If you'd like to sort of take a look with the ideas I've been sort of floating around with staff there and been talking to some harvesters and sort of getting some input from you, and we could go over that if you want me to go ahead and put that up there. But before I do that, when we talked about transitioning some of these areas to less efficient gear types like hand tong or patent tongs, I can distribute these a little bit. But there are areas right now that, based on what we've seen in deep rock, what anyone who worked Area 6 hoghouse area probably saw when it was open in 2016, where there are oyster densities in the Rappahannock, for example, Area 2 on Sturgeons and North End. There, the market oyster densities right now in those areas are above 10 markets per square meter on those bars. So those areas have densities high enough where they could support a patent tongue or less efficient gear. You could fish on those areas for three months, and probably the impact would be less than 2 months of hand scrape. So I'm not advocating that that's the change that needs to happen today, but that's something to consider, that those areas, and it's tricky in terms of regulatory area to carve an area out like that. I understand that, but it's something to sort of know that those two areas in Area 2 that are scheduled to be opened up this year have market densities of 11.4 and 18.6, which is 18.6 is high enough where you can make that work with hand tongs. So that's something to consider, is do we want to open that area up to scrape, knock it back down in the hopes that you get a spat set 2 or 3 years from now, maybe, or do you want to leave that area open for 3 months this year? Something just to consider.
Hand tong or patent tong?
Well, I'm just saying that the density is high enough where it could support either one of those gears.
Water's too deep in Area 2, hand tong.
Yeah, but that, I mean, I'm hypothetically speaking, right, on the hand tong there. But those, unless you got a really long set. But and Area 4 there, again, a lot of that increase that we have seen there is being carried by just one piece of drum and ground there. The inshore piece furthest up the Croatoan has got market densities of over 20 there right now. So that's an area.
Good last opening.
Yeah. But a lot of the other areas, you know, they're in that 2 to 5 range. So that's just one area that, based on what we've seen on Hoghouse, Area 6, and on Deep Rock, could support a fishery other than hand scrape and dredge, and that it might not recover again to that level until we get another spat set. That also was the case with blackberry hangs, is the market densities prior to the season last year were up over 20, so that was an area that I'm not sure, we haven't resurveyed it now, but that area could support a less efficient gear type and still produce the same number of market oysters as it had been. I mean, the effort would be a little higher. You wouldn't be back at 8 o'clock, but you'd be back at noon with an 8-bushel limit.
Mr. Chairman, Andrew, on blackberry, can you rewind here? You planted shells. Was it fossil shells this year?
Yes, yes.
Do you know how many bushels was it? You don't have to give it to me now.
It was about 15,000 or so, 1,100. Yeah, about 16,000 or so.
And you said you don't have like a stocks assessment right now. But
I don't have a graph showing for that one, but it has been. It hasn't had a lot of effort recently, but it has. It is showing right now that it's prior to the last season was an area that was getting better.
You haven't seen it after. You haven't checked after this last harvest.
No.
It was about. You said 60 boats. It was more like 90. Mm-hmm.
They got worked over pretty good last year.
It might be worth considering a lay year on the, even though you don't have it in a rotation. And you know, I guess if you could survey it, it may make sense to give that a time to recover.
Yeah, I think we could. We had talked about including that in the rotation, and I think the sentiment at the time was that it was a unique area and not that many people worked it, and I guess some people figured out how to work it. So I think it would make sense to possibly include that in the rotation with the Great Wicomico there, that lower area, which was, I think, initially our original intent there.
Would patent tongue be an option there? Would that iron ore? I don't know.
Well, you might not, they call it the hangs for a reason, I imagine. So,
I don't think patent tongue would be an option there with that iron ore. What do you think?
It can't be much worse than deep rock.
No, it can't. It caught a lot of tongues last year in deep rock.
Yeah.
We used to pat tongs. I pat tongs up there for years.
Yeah. I believe it. I'm agree with Tom. It needs some type of maybe a little bit of break. You got worked right hard last year. Mm-hmm. Real hard.
You know, it's a combination. I think it was sort of the way the season was structured. It was a combination of things. But I was for leaving it open. I felt like, you know, up until last year, I'd done a maximum of 15 boats.
20, 25.
You know, and it was mostly area boats, and then last year it was not
there. It actually looked like a city.
Yeah. Well, this February with these outliers here without the James or the Rappahannock, I mean, that's something that I don't think we can have this year is these outliers like that. So I think we need to shift something on either or both of these ends to sort of keep that pressure spread out with the number of harvests we had before we continue to some of these late season areas that are standing alone like that just can't take it. So. And I guess, again, the other areas that could support a different gear type right now, so we've gone over blackberry hangs and areas in the Rappahannock. Ballard's Marsh, which I know is a shallow area, probably don't want a patent tong there because you don't want to hit yourself in the face with a pair of tongs when they come up. But that area's got densities higher than 10, so close to 13. Ballard's Marsh on the Smithfield side, just a bug bridge there. James River.
Oh, the bridge.
Yeah, right next to the bridge there. So it's a shallow area. It is hard to plant shell there. You got to time the tides, but that is an area that, I mean, it's got a lot of small oysters right now and a lot of market oysters. So that's an area that you could switch over to hand tong there potentially. And I think people would be pretty happy to catch 12 bushels there, and I think you could do it. You worked there at Ballard's Marsh, and you've seen the oysters that came off there. How much water do you have under your boat there, Don?
Not much.
Yeah.
Not much was, but it was. I don't know, 6 feet. Mm-hmm. I got tons. You could patent tong. I wouldn't want to patent tong. Somebody tear the boat up.
Are they ever least 10 above.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that chain comes out.
Shaft
chain.
So that would be an option there, but it's, I think there's, the density's high enough where it could support that, the hand tong fishery there. And then in the York River, there isn't an area right now that is scheduled to open that could support a different gear type, and those areas are, again, at best, you know, the deeper parts of Timberneck are 12-foot. But there are some areas in Aberdeen for next year that have, you know, a few patches here and there. We split that area up into three different areas, but one of the areas has densities high enough where it could get transitioned to a different gear type there in Aberdeen, that rock there. So they're up over 15 in one spot there. And we can check that again. We'll see, have sort of better information, but that's something that could happen. And I know it's a lot of information there, but this is sort of, with our discussion of 15 to 25 years of fossil shell remaining, that the sooner that we gradually make this transition, potentially, to some of these less efficient gear types in areas that can support it, will allow us to focus our replenishment effort in areas that have higher spat sets where you could maintain that dredge and scrape fishery. But if we don't start to do that, eventually we're going to come to an edge where either it's cost prohibitive to keep replenishing at the same levels that we are, or we have 2 or 3 years with bad spat sets, and instead of the fishery kind of gradually going up and down the way it has been, you have a sharp drop. And that's something that I think concerns all of us there, and that's sort of why I'm trying to present the best information I have for you to make a recommendation and advise the commission on the route to go, not just this year, but looking forward as far as you can. Are there any other questions before I was going to pull up a Excel spreadsheet there to sort of show what I've been playing around with in terms of proposed harvest season for this year, but is there any other information that you'd like for that I can try to provide this week or to prepare for?
Is it a big problem to go back to this bat set slides for Pickle River, the Rappahannock? Those numbers. I guess one question, we talk about the spat sets. When you go back and look at the harvest for the last 5 or 6 years, we had some pretty good harvest behind non-record spat sets.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess just keeping that in mind, that these spat sets don't always translate into huge harvest and vice versa.
Now, well, 2014 is one of those good exceptions to that, as we didn't have great spat sets for 3 years, but we had one in 2010 that was about as high as it has been in Area 5, and you can see that does kind of track with the number of markets going up, and this was that year where not only were there a large number of markets there, but that effort really increased at the same time. So you're definitely right that the number of harvest isn't necessarily dependent on that spat set being in the previous year, but if there's, you know, it does usually track pretty well. If you look at, well, just look at the Area 5 there in the Rappahannock over the last 5 years, and then.
And where I was going with that, the other thing that you see in those areas specifically is a lot of oysters over 3.5 inches dead when you get to that third year. So. Yeah, you can really see it in the sanctuary slides, but
you compare the harvest area to the sanctuary area. There's the decline in the markets.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do get that, and then you'll
15 and 16, and then 17 and 18. If mm-hmm. it's a sanctuary, it's something other than harvest.
Yeah, I mean that. I'm not
just
saying
trying to build in the anoxia thing that we keep seeing there. Mm-hmm. That if, you know, I'm still not convinced that this 3 years is the way to go. We're losing. I mean, in the numbers I've tracked and what I've watched through these slides, basically we lose a year's crop every third in what's dead when we go
back that third year. It's, and I don't, the gear type's immaterial to that, but it's just, it seems such a shame, and I think we'll see it pretty heavily in Area 2 this year. We saw it in Area 2. It's a lot more prevalent in the lower part of the river, but JC or Ernie, you could speak to this, and Wayne, you might have worked one of those areas, but...
So, I understand where you're coming from.
I mean, it's just...
We might be waiting too long on these deep water areas, and...
Well, working on the assumption that you're holding something in the bank is incorrect. Because you're not putting them on the shelf disabled later.
I guess most of these graphs focus on the live oysters, but what's really held in the bank that I can prepare some slides for you isn't so much the market size oysters. It is to a certain extent. I mean, a certain portion of those will die, and a certain portion of them will live. But those large oysters are the majority of the shell that make that reef. So I mean, oysters is one of those unique fisheries where you're, by nature of fishing, you're taking the habitat the fishery depends on. So although these are market numbers that you're seeing in sanctuary areas here, they have the shell base to support a recovery, whereas if we don't replenish, which is what you don't see on the sanctuary areas, is the replenishment effort is happening on the harvest areas. It's happening at a much lighter level in these sanctuary areas. So if you take those market oysters, you're also losing that shell base, and if that shell base isn't put back, you won't get the spat sets and you won't get the markets. And that's part of the other reason for the rotation, is it allows us to replenish these areas in that rotation so that you can plant the shell, get the spat set, and then harvest it. And if you go to a two-year rotation, it may well save some of those deep water oysters where we don't replenish, but in the areas where we are replenishing, that could be problematic.
And on that note, these public harvest areas, the majority of that area is a natural rock, just the same as these fossil shells were centuries and centuries ago that you're now digging, that you're saying there's a 40-foot stripe of shell in the bottom. This is the same thing, just sticking above the bottom. So just because you rake off the top 2 inches, there's still whatever that profile is above the bottom, it still consists of shell. Just because you're taking the top layer off doesn't mean you're stripping the bottom bare of shell. That's another very common misconception, a misperception, I should say.
Well, each area is different, so that may be the case in some areas there, but if you look at all of the Rappahannock, those shell layers might not be 40 feet deep, and some of those
lumps... They're more than a spread of 10 liters per square meter or something such as that, too.
Well, I guess it doesn't really matter in terms of producing an oyster what's underneath the mud. It matters what's above the mud.
I'm not speaking of what's under the mud.
Right, but...
I'm just saying when you scrape off that top living layer, you're also uncovering another layer, something that's not as old as what you're planting every year with the fossil shells.
If you were working on top of a continuous reef deposit like that, that would be the case in some areas, but is not universally the case in most areas. Our patentong crabs go below into the mud underneath, so when we get through those areas, that brown shell volume, we're not finding another layer of shell. So they're going deeper than a dredge or a scrape would. So in the majority of these areas, you're not seeing what you say there to be the case.
Mr. Chairman, Andrew, what Tommy and everybody's referring to is a common problem that my watermen bring in, tell me every year, that their large oysters are dying, and it's just a three-year rotation, and they tell me this every year and year, that four-inch oysters are dying. And to me, it's worth more as a market oyster than letting it set and be in a shell eventually down the bottom. It doesn't make any sense to me, but you look into some of these graphs here, and you got your market oysters that keep going down without any harvest. I mean, where does that come from?
If you look, they start here, they're harvested, this is the harvest areas, they recover. They're harvested, and they recover. Sanctuary areas fluctuate more because they're not getting the replenishment effort. but they're relatively stable. So you get your markets that go up and down and up and down. There's going to be some natural mortality there. But like what you're seeing in the, is if you look back, you see this was right after it was harvested. So it gradually recovers. Same thing. This was right after it was harvested, gradually recovers. So you're seeing that these three-year rotations are allowing this fat set here to grow to these markets over here. And the same thing, this fat set here is growing to these markets over here. And you can see that other graphs sort of demonstrate that better, where you can track the smalls too. So you can see a fat set.
It doesn't show the mortality, I'm sorry, Andrew, but it doesn't show the mortality. And just like Mr. Johnson said here, you had a reef there that just shows it going down and nobody's worked it. You know, nobody's worked it whatsoever.
I think down to below the bridge grows a lot different than above the bridge. I mean, forest and oysters.
You definitely have...
I mean, they grow a lot faster, and they die a lot quicker for some reason.
Well, it's that nature of the higher salinity areas is usually the higher salinity. You get sort of nowadays a 3 to 5 year lifespan on your oysters typically, whereas lower salinity areas, you can look at sort of 4 to 8 years. So...
I guess
would say
area
one
looks just as good above as
an
area two right now. If you
looked at it. Just, I mean, we're getting out of the box and the thinking of gear types and this sort of thing. We're in a 20, and I keep saying this, I know you guys get tired of hearing it. We're in a 20-year one-size-fits-all strategy in the Rappahannock. And we were, you know, 3 years in when we set these up, we were going to take a look at this. And you know, it's 20 years later and it's still the perfect way to do it. And we, you know, we never look at that side of it. And I, you know, but I see the up and down in the graph, but I could probably take some information and show a graph just the opposite of it. But I really wish some thought would be put into just these larger oysters. And even if, you know, you're going 2 years, skip 2 years, something, I mean, we're losing a lot of resource. And, you know, the stock assessments, I understand those when you're right on the reefs where you do them, but they don't take anything into consideration for where in area two, 50% of the harvest, or even area five until this year. Obviously, anoxia was a problem, but there's, I just think we really need to get strategic about this other than just these little boxed in areas and using the same strategy that we've used forever. If that's the case, I guess we just, it is what it is and we continue down the road. But at some point, if we start changing gear types and these numbers go down, like by design you would have them do, you know, we talk about the replenishment going back, at what time, what point did the dollars get so low that someone says this doesn't make sense to keep funneling money in?
Well, I think the idea would be long term is take an area like areas 3, 2, and 1 and then a Rappahannock there. So this is an area that does have higher salinity, generally gets higher recruitment, and you do have that shorter lifespan like you're talking about. So if we don't have to focus our effort in some of these upriver areas where your oysters may well, if you're not getting anoxia freshwater events, might be living 4, 5, 6, 7 years. I think Brian Carnegie of IMS had some good information last time about the disease pressure being much less than it was. So, I mean, looking forward, I think that the long-term death is going to be less of a concern, particularly in these upriver areas, and that's something that we could start considering is in some of these higher salinity, higher mortality areas, adjusting the rotation there in them.
That's precisely where I'm going. It may be that you have from the bridge to from area 3 to area 1, you have a different strategy than you do from, just because, you know, Dr. Wesson set this up in 2000 and whatever, just to get us started. You know, I think we never did go back and revisit, does it make sense? It was like, it's closed. This is the way it is. It's the way it's been. But I think we're at a point where we need to think, you know, do we manage that rotation up the river totally different than we do down? I mean, it's nothing to stop us from doing that. It's just a matter of deciding what makes the most sense based on the science and what you've got to work with.
Well, I agree with you there that it doesn't have to be the same way forever. I mean, it used to be different, but the resource does change. But it is something to think about what works in other rivers. As you look at, I know everything's different, and it's hard to compare any one tributary to a tributary, which is sometimes where we get hung up. But if you look at areas like the James, they have a relatively high density, stable population upriver, and no rotation, high recruitment areas downriver. That's sort of right now kind of missing in the Rappahannock. So it might be when we get something like Area 4 there or Area 6 that has this high population of oysters there, if we take some of those areas, not all of a sudden there, but transition sort of those areas in combination with our sanctuaries that we have now, to a less efficient gear type, so you're keeping more oysters up there, then I think that it would be more comfortable to sort of make those adjustments in the downriver areas where it might make sense to have a two-year rotation. But to sort of take the whole thing and chop it up when it, I mean, it has admittedly, until last year, been working fairly well in terms of the number of market oysters. I'm not saying that it's been working perfectly.
But it still doesn't address the amount that died. Yeah, what would that number have been if you captured those oysters?
Right. Well, I think part of the problem is that it's deep water oysters. Primarily, are we talking about? Or are we talking about the shallow water oysters?
Yeah, I'm talking about it in an aggregate number with the two of them. I mean, we've almost always in staff assessments or in, I mean, I brought it up, and I'm not being critical of the stock assessment, but if I go back 15 years and look at the stock assessment of what we planned on versus what's harvested, there's no correlation. So obviously the stock assessment, I've got faith in as far as where you're doing it. It's just a lot going on in other places that aren't built into that number.
Right. I mean,
but we're making decisions based on...
Well, I mean, I think that part of the thing that the stock assessment can't take into account is obviously all those areas and sort of patchy areas where with a scraper or dredge you can catch oysters. But the other thing that, you know, we have to consider there is that those areas, particularly the deeper water areas there, an anoxic event is going to kill those oysters whether it's a one-year rotation or a two-year rotation. And those are common in the deep water areas of the Rappahannock. So I mean, I guess in theory you're a little more likely to get them before they're dead that 1 year, but they're still going to die in those anoxic events, and I don't think it's necessarily the disease or waiting 3 years is killing them.
Well, but you still, even with the anoxic events, you don't see the death of small oysters as you do with the larger stuff. Mm-hmm. We see
these areas we're talking about, how long does it take an oyster to get 3 inches?
Usually about 2 to 3 years. So it depends, again, on where the oyster is. They grow differently in different areas, but most areas, you're looking at 2 to 3 years to get to from spat to market size. Some areas, much quicker. Higher salinity areas, probably closer to 2 years. Lower salinity areas, maybe longer than 3 years. The mobjack, sometimes never. that's sort of the case. It's very area specific.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, this is something we've been seeing for years after year after year after year. It's large horses, and you know, they just told me 1 year, I would say, okay, it's a hiccup, you know, we'll see next year. The same problem next year. It's the large horses dying in these areas near the mouth of the Rappahannock. It's been a problem. I guess you guys have seen it down there, too?
We see it when we work there.
Why don't you just take one area in the lower Rappahannock and try a two-year rotation on it?
Mm-hmm.
Like Area 1 has been closed for 2 years. Open that up with Area 4 and see what happens.
Well, I guess you... What would you expect to happen, I guess?
I would say Area 1 would probably be better than Area 4, is what I would say.
This year? Well, right this year, yeah, it probably would be.
Because it's 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because
Area 4 only has 4 per square meter.
I mean, not 4, but Area 2.
Mm-hmm. No, Area 2 is going to be better than
I say, but I bet your Area 1 will be just as good as Area 2.
Mm-hmm.
or 2 years to pay 3 years. Well, it's not about.
Mm-hmm. I mean, well, each area is gonna be different, but it's you know.
I'm just saying, you try one.
Sure. I mean, if it's been 2 years and you worked on it this year, you can certainly compare it to how it was 2 years ago.
Well, I mean, you can look. Let me pull something up here.
I mean, the only way you're going, I would know is try.
Exactly right.
Instead of doing one big thing, just open one.
Andrew, why can't you go out there in 2 years, or when 2 years is coming up, and sample these rocks and see what's on them? I mean, if there's marketable oysters on them, let them catch them.
Well, we do sample them every year. So this is area one here.
Let me ask you a question. What are you sampling them with?
Hydraulic patent tongs. So they take...
Oh, we go to a dredge.
Well, the dredge gives you... It gives you how quickly you can catch the oysters. It doesn't give you what's on the bottom. It gives you what's in the dredge bag.
This is area two.
This is area one right here.
The reason that you have 3-year rotation, is it because you're trying to preserve broodstock, or is it? I mean, what's the rationale for 3-year versus 2-year, and then in Hookhook Sound, Tanger Sound, you're on a 2-year rotation.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a lot of difference between Tanger, Hookhook, and the lower Rappahannock from the standpoint of salinities and reproduction?
Well, if you look at parts of the 2-year rotation, the Pocomoke Sound, they've gone the opposite direction of the lower Rappahannock in most recent years. So most of the time, that 2-year rotation in some spots in the Pocomoke, Shell Rock being an example, it probably needed a 3-year rotation. So the harvest numbers and the market oyster density has generally not recovered in the 2-year rotation and has gone down, and it's required heavier replenishment effort to bring back up to market harvest levels. So not having a two-year rotation requires more replenishment input. So yes, those oysters do die, but it's part of the you're not having to replenish those areas as much. So the 3-year cycle in the Rappahannock allows us to replenish areas every 3 years as opposed to every 2 years. And if we don't do it every 2 years in 2-year rotations, or every 1 year like we do in the James, then you see harvest numbers go down. So replenishment can't keep up now with the level of oyster harvest in the Rappahannock. If we were to go to 2-year rotations, we'd have to increase our replenishment there to higher than it is now, most likely to maintain the production that we have.
Andrew, what replenishment is in the lower Rappahannock and Tanger Sound, the shale play?
That's correct.
So it's not sea oysters.
That's correct.
So what, I mean, are we losing shells because of the, would we be losing shells because of 2-year rotation versus 3-year rotation?
It's the same limit. I mean, I'm not advocating, we're not going to raise limits. We're going to take, you know, assuming that someone worked that entire season, what's our typical, say, area do? Let's just talk about that since that's what's slated to open. Our typical area two is what, 2 months?
Yep.
So 40 working days?
Mm-hmm.
40 working days. And you're going to have, you know, basically the same amount of oysters harvested. I mean, we're not looking to get a bumper crop out of this. We're going to get the same amount. But we're going to allow the population and the density increase because we're going to take the big oysters that are dying. And obviously, you're going to leave more smaller oysters behind it.
Well, I guess, are you saying, let's say, between the three areas in the lower Rappahannock, you have 6 months, roughly, in terms of 2 months, 2 months, and 2 months.
No, I'm saying if you just rotate every other year around and you got that same 40 days any way you cut it, I'm not advocating increasing bushel limits, increasing anything. All I'm advocating is that three areas down there, you try just going to every other year around, and it's nothing to say that we have to have that broken into three areas. It could be broken into two areas.
Mm-hmm. No.
I mean, we sat down here in I can't remember if it was your office or Jim's office, with a big map and said, well, I think what will sell and what's going to work here is we'll do this three and this three. And then Jim took a big marker and marked out where the sanctuaries needed to be, and that's how these were established. It's not like they were established on any kind of scientific matrix. It was basically, you know, here's three areas. So I just don't understand letting these big oysters die, hammering the little oysters to try to get enough big oysters in that 40 days. I don't think you're going to see the level of replenishment that, I mean, you're requiring more replenishment because you've let them die, plus you grind the little ones trying to get enough big ones in that 40 days.
Well, I guess I can talk to our colleagues at VIMS there, and we do track the number of dead oysters on these patentong areas, on these hydraulically our survey areas there. So I can pull together some numbers of actually to see if there are a large number of dead oysters there. And part of the other reason that oysters die isn't just because we're leaving them there. It's because, I mean, an oyster box, you know, if an area is harvested on, it can last for a little while. So that harvest activity is part of what can kill some of these larger oysters that are missed. So you might see that in there as well.
Andrew,
we can pull those numbers to sort of actually have some scientific basis to look at the number of dead oysters in these areas, as opposed to the sort of anecdotal stuff that we're basing it on, based on harvesters and sampling with a hand scrape.
Andrew, all due respect, you got these graphs up here, and they're wonderful, but you also had a graph up there showing that most of the oysters harvested were from private industry. Am I correct? I don't know about, you know,
time. Some years, but yeah.
Well, everybody, people in the industry here now, we don't do 3 years. We do 2 years. I don't let my stuff set 2-3 years. It's, you know, we work on it every 2 years.
Actually sample it, and when it's the best time to harvest it, it's the mm-hmm. best time to harvest it. If it's a year, if it's 2 years, if it's 5 years.
But it never ever goes 3 years.
It's a fluid management process. It's not a stuff, but we worked there last year, so we can't go back for 3 more years.
You take a small oyster, 2.5 inches, when the season's over, when he sits out 3 years, he's going to die before you harvest him.
Our problem with the Pokemon, we didn't have a spass up. I can tell you, I would drop a drudge on that every year. It's illegal. The last day coming up to see what we had for the next year. We'd have a solid drudge full, 2.5, 2.75, some 3-inch oysters. Brother-in-law asked me, so what did it look like? I said, well, I don't know what's going to be next year because all we got is the little ones. And I'd done that for 3 years straight. And we went down there that next year. We couldn't believe it. They were big as your hand. And that's the problem in the Pokemon same. You don't need a 3-year rotation. You need a spat set. That place has been great for years and years and years. What happened was we didn't get a spat set. You don't get a spat set. I don't care. You can wait 10 years. You're not going to have any oysters. And that's what's happening to Pokemon. I don't like a 3-year rotation. I mean, where are we going to work? If we keep going to 3-year, we're running out of places to work now and two.
Well, I mean, I think you're going to run out of places to work quicker if you go to 2 in other areas. On the spat set is this is what harvest does to spat. So that's another thing that going to a 2-year rotation you need to take into account. Is it's not just harvest, it's mortality and everything, but oyster harvest, turning over all those oysters, if you do get a good spat set, it doesn't give them a chance to grow up. So that's sort of the other aspect that you're going to get into in a 2-year rotation, is if you do get a good spat set, say that 1 year, then instead of having 3 years to roll the dice for a good spat set, you really have 1 or 2 years. And you're going to harvest right on top of a good spat set and knock it back down. And you're recovering.
I understand where you're coming from there. I mean, that same thing happened at Pokemon. The first year when Jim opened it up, we done good. The second year he opened it up, people were going down there killing 10 bushels to catch one. A lot of us went to Tanger. You're saying you cannot sit there and trudge through small oysters. And I called Jim up. I told him, I said, it didn't come from me, but you need to shut this tank. And he said that was a law enforcement issue. But which it's not really, because we had guys in there who work all day long to catch 3 or 4 bushels, but look what you're killing. Mm-hmm. And the next year, we dropped a drudge on it. They're all dead. I bet you it was 98% of them dead. and it's a management area. I think we should start managing it. If it should be shut down, you shut it down. If it should be opened up, you open it up. I mean, you know, I've been doing this for 45 years. And that's the way I felt about it the whole time. If it needs to be shut down, shut it down. It'll irritate some people, but the people that want to make a living all year long and for years to come are going to agree with you.
Just a comment. I think it's an important consideration to address the spawning potential of a one-year-old oyster compared to a two or three, even if a three or four-year-old oyster is going to die. You know, how many more millions of eggs is that two-year-old oyster or three-year-old oyster contributing to future spat sets? And maybe it's not significant, but maybe it is too. So I just wanted to make that comment too. And maybe there's information that could be presented. You know, on a one-inch oyster versus two, how many millions of oysters would be spawning in a season?
I always thought that's what these sanctuaries are for, to give us our spawn and our spat set. I mean, they're the prime best spots that we have for oysters to live at. It's on these sanctuaries around these areas that we have to work. But that's what I always thought. Rob?
So Andrew's going to check on this disease incidence, okay? And I don't mean to make light of the death of the larger oysters, because that's what I heard in all the time that I was here in the late 80s and the early 90s, and we know what happened after that. So things are different now than they were then. There has been a successful replenishment thanks to the efforts of all those who in 2013 were able to get to $2 million for repletion. And that's now going to go up to $2.5 million, or did. So at a minimum, your comments today, I've never heard so many comments about the two-year rotation. I have heard it before. It has come up before. But there's more of a concerted effort. So you have to allow us to go back and look at areas and give the pros and cons, whatever they may be, of these areas, and then come back to you in August and go through it then. I don't think it should just be, let's do it. I think if we do it, we have to have a basis for why we're doing that. And Andrew's going to do part of the work with the, with VIMS, with information, and that's probably the way to proceed. And we realize already, you're just talking about select areas that have been problematic. And we are faced with a greater degree of anoxia. And we'll even look, I think we know about the spawning capabilities by age of oysters, but at the same time, I'm not sure we can balance everything by August as far as what we might lose or not lose. But there's enough concern on the committee that, I don't think Andrew is expecting all of this exactly. Some of you may have talked to him individually, I'm not sure. But I think, we need time to sort this out and give you a, sort of pro and con by those areas. And if you want to talk to Andrew in the meantime, that may help him along. The one other thing I wanted to mention is you started out talking about the shell and the longevity of the fossil shell, maybe 15 or 25 years. So I don't know who remembers when the Corps did their exploratory work in various areas, but the problem was the Corps did not go deep enough in those areas, and the cost of redoing that survey wasn't prohibitive, but it was a lot. And so, yes, there are other shell deposits out there. Maybe at a later time, Andrew can bring that information to refresh you, or for those who aren't aware of that study. And I'm going to say offhand, it probably goes back about 8 years, 8 or 7 years, something like that. So I did want to mention that. And I also wanted to mention, you're not exactly having absolute information. So the patent tom was designed and was put up
to the commission in 1993, and there was a lot of flack about it. But the good thing about the patent, Tom, you get one square meter, you're getting reproducibility, which is science. Science has to be reproducible. And, you know, that's the savings grace there. But it's something that, you know, you have to take everything together and look at it. Look at the SPAC to young or, you know, yearlings to market, and look at the continuum of it, as Andrew's trying to show you. It may be that Area 1 is a little bit better. I mean, Area 2, I mean, but it may also be that if you did a statistical test on everything, you would find that there's overlap for a lot of these data. And we'll try and talk about that a little bit too, you know, so you can have, you know, better understanding that, you know, we're doing our best to provide you with really good, as current as possible information. And we all know that oysters have been on the top shelf, right? And they've been heralded in the press starting about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And now we're in a situation where Andrew opens up and he's telling you that maybe we're talking about 540,000 bushels or whatever Andrew said there. And all of you are very aware that, well, we've been higher than that for several years. And so I think all of us have some concern as to, we want to make sure that there's some sort of sustainability. And I think Tommy was really talking about that, that his interest is not to get the bumper crop. His interest is that we have sustainability. And we seem to be there, right, for several years in a row, and still can be, but it takes your efforts to really think about sustainability more so than the current coming season. And, you know, that'll help everyone out, including the commission. So appreciate the opportunity to make a few comments, Mr. Chairman, and I thank you.
Yeah, thank you for getting us back on track. I guess we'll get Andrew will get us back going on this upcoming season.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Have you all talked about, I mean, obviously you talked about different areas, obviously, for several minutes, but have you talked about the James River for the coming year? Because I had one phone call and wanted to bring up something to run by the committee today, and Andrew, I've already talked to him about that, but is it a good time,
appropriate
time now to discuss that?
Yeah, I think so. You can come forward and let us know what you heard.
Okay.
Yeah, well, the comments were made that perhaps White Shoal could be open the 15th of October, take pressure off the Rappahannock, if the Rappahannock was going to be open the 15th of October. And I understand in talking with Andrew that there are a lot of small oysters there, but this individual indicated that perhaps a 2 3/4 inch co-log could be put on White Shoal for 2 weeks until the season opened in James River the 1st of November. So I'd present that today, let the committee consider it, see if there's any support for it, and if there's no support, then that's one thing. If there is support for it, perhaps it could be considered in the plan that's going to come back in August to be discussed, to be adopted this year.
All right, thank you. Any discussion on that, or is anything, any comments on that?
What would we do with the 2 3/4 inch oyster industry? I mean, I don't think you're going to shuck a 2 3/4 inch oyster, and I'm not sure that there's a market set in place for it. I mean, you have to, most customers are used to getting a 3 inch oyster. That would be my concern on that.
I mean, 2 1/2, you go get the 2 3/4.
Well, yeah, exactly.
I think it might also be that, I mean, in October, it's probably not the best shucking oyster there in the James River there, so I'm presuming it would be for a box market there. But in terms of White Shoal specifically, I think I had pulled this graph up earlier, but this was an area that had, that was one of the last areas open in the James. It saw some of the highest pressure that it had seen in recent years. So both the substrate levels, brown shell volume there, dropped substantially compared to previous years. And this graph right here that you're looking at is just White Shoal. So this is the number of small oysters, those 2 3/4 inch and below. And you can see after last year's harvest, a lot of those 2 3/4 inch oysters, which is here, this is in the spring post-harvest season, have already left White Shoal. So I'm not sure exactly where they went, but they're not there anymore.
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, it's
they're escorted to market.
I think that White Shoal probably could use a break.
Just to present the idea and see if they support. Certainly, the three is worth.
There's enough of them sneaking out already.
But I'll go ahead and throw up what I've been looking at for a season option there, and this is just something that we can discuss. It's not by any means the end all and be all here. But let me zoom this in here. So I'll start with the James River there. Can you see that all right? So in the previous seasons, we had this split up into these rotation areas the last 2 years, the hand scrape areas there. And we had that sort of staggered from October through January there. Prior to that, this had been sort of the traditional James River hand scrape season in mid-November to December there. I think that based on the pressure that it saw last year, some of that this might be a good season to shift back to that. I'm willing to admit that 4 years there was some concern that might be too long in the James from both harvesters and from myself, and it looks like, given the way that the last season was, that 4 months there last season may have been too long for the James River, and it may behoove us to shorten that season. This is just sort of my explanation for why I put this where I did. Feel free when we're done to comment on it. And we went over some of those areas in the lower James that could support going to hand tong. So if people want to try it, I don't think it would hurt anything to have those areas open to hand tong, the whole James River open to hand tong all of October, basically. So if people want to try, there's going to be some patches in the lower areas where it probably will be easier to get market oysters in some of those upriver areas. So that would get market oysters coming on pretty strong. I showed you that graph earlier, 21% of the harvest is coming from hand tongers, mostly from the James. So there's a lot of, if people want to go hand tong in the James, there's a lot of market oysters there to start things out in October. So that's something to consider, and that's sort of the reason why I have those the way that they are. And this is proposed in draft, so this is not final.
Andrew, mm-hmm. Is that 21%, does that include seed harvest, or is that just
market? No, that
market
was just market. Okay. Yep. Seed oyster harvest, I think I did mention this in the update harvest numbers there, but we had, I believe, about 37,000 bushels or so, give or take, remaining in the seed quota this year, and I think that was probably a good thing in terms of the seed areas. I showed you in those earlier graphs that both the markets and smalls, combined with the freshwater mortality, it's probably good that those 40,000 or so bushels stayed in Virginia. So there could be some future discussion. I know we talked about some of the seed areas potentially. We could make an adjustment, particularly Point of Shoals there, maybe an area where we might want to go clean cull only this year. It's an area that's seen a lot of continuous seed harvest, and it's an area that has been getting worked down, but it does produce generally a larger market oyster, so that's something to think about too. But this is sort of the reasoning behind the James. York area too, again, it's going to be about the same as it was when it was opened in the 3 years ago there in the 15-16 season. And I think it got worked pretty well, so I'm sort of proposing just that 1 month season. I'll get to this asterisk there in a little bit, but just in February there. Melford Haven, again, sort of stayed the same traditional hand tongue in that area. There's a few boats that work out of there off Quinn's Island. The Deep Rock Patent Tongue area, I think leaving that as is. And this is, mind you, without any adjustments to two-year rotation. This is if we just stick with what we've been doing for the most part, sort of working within that box, if you will. Area 2 is going to be the more productive area in the Rappahannock based on our survey and probably based on what we've seen in Area 3 and 5 compared to last year. I think there are definitely areas in Area 2 where you could make a day's work with patent tongs there. In November, I have that opening up to hand scrape. That'll sort of take care of that November need for oysters there. And I have that taken a little bit of time off there and opening again there in February. Again, Area 4, there's going to be that area, Drummond Ground, that could support a patent tong fishery there. I don't think it's going to hold up as much as Area 4 is, but there's going to be other areas coming on in December, but I think it would still provide that sort of boost of market oysters there in December going into the Christmas season. And would probably, 2 months might be a little bit of a stretch in that area, but that's something we could look at. We'd have better information at that point based on our patent tong survey. I mean, if needed, could make an adjustment there in that December season, January season for Area 4. The upriver areas 8 and 7 and 8, we planted seed in those areas this year, and I don't think it would be good to go back to those areas. We also had some of that freshwater mortality, so not have those areas come on this year. Area 9, again, it's a small area. I think there's been some issues with oysters leaving up there too, but Area 9 would stay the same hand tong season there. Great Wicomico is one of those areas that was left hanging out in February, if you will, last year, and I think having Area 2, which was that better looking area, come online in February would help alleviate some of that pressure from Great Wicomico. I think we could go ahead and do a 2 month season there, but leave it as hand scrape. This is, as we discussed there, is we could maybe leave it as patent tong for that same sort of concurrent 3 months and see if people want to try it out there, or maybe 2 months there. But I think that we definitely want to look at that before opening it up after the 60 to 90 boats that we saw there. Little Wicomico Cone, these are the hand tong areas up the northern neck there. The Wicomico was the area where we planted seed in those two areas, so the other areas that have been opened there would be open, but I think it was public ground 102. It's Walker's and O'Beers, I believe, would be the two areas that got seed planted this year that would be not open in the Wicomico. Tangier, Pocomoke Sound. Last season, we'd had a shortened season there in the Pocomoke Sound side of things by a whole month. And I think, in part, that was a good thing, but that also shifted some effort over to Tangier Sound. So that's where we get to this asterisk here. So there's other ways we could look at this in terms of adjusting bushel limits or days. But I think that what might prevent some of that grinding longer than you should is sort of shortening the harvest day in February across the board for all the hand scrape and dredge areas, potentially shortening it to noon. If you're scraping and dredging and you don't have a limit by noon, you're probably damaging the rock there. And I know there's weather, there's late starts, but I think that would give people enough time to, if the oysters are there, to catch them in time, but if they're not, to not stay out there until 2 on top of things. So that would be just floating the ideas right now. And the seaside is one of those areas where I think if there was more market for the hand harvest oysters, you might get some effort to shift out there. I mean, there's probably, by number, more oysters on the seaside of the Eastern Shore than there are in the whole Chesapeake Bay. You just have to know where to go, know where to find them, and be willing to stand in the mud and pick them up by hand. But it's one of those areas that I think could be you know, could see some effort shift there, particularly the hand areas. It could probably support that if there was market for those oysters out there. Just something to consider. And again, we had gone to hand tong in deep water areas only there. So the regulatory change was made last year to allow hand tonging in areas that there are a few areas on the seaside that don't have dry at low tide. And there are a few spots that might have some deep water oysters, but the majority of areas that do support oysters over there are all intertidal. So on those intertidal areas, we keep the restriction of by hand only, which means you have to literally be out of your boat using your hands. You can't rake them up into a pile and cull off your boat. You got to be standing on the rock with your feet in the mud, picking by hand. But, you know, people have got six to eight bushels on a good day in spots out there, and they are pretty quality oyster.
I know absolutely nothing about that oyster or that fishery, but is it a possibility? I know in Louisiana and Alabama they have that nipper tong fishery in those sort of areas that you're using, you know, something like this. Is that, do you think that would get any more effort? Or
I'm not exactly sure, but it's one of those areas are very hard to replenish, and I think that they're shallow enough that you can work them reaching over. They are intertidal, and there is the same 2 p.m. restriction over there. So
he has to use Tommy Long belt like that. You can't stand there bagels because it would kill you. Kill you in littles, but really kill you in the bagels. Mm-hmm. But most of it's just picking up. You got to have a bag made like a slinky. And I don't have one.
Well, I guess if you're really going for it, what I've seen done over there is you harvest at a low tide, you put your bushels up in the marsh, and you come back at a high tide and pick them up.
Those guys are good.
But, I mean, there's not maybe 20, 24 people now who are really consistently doing it. But there are a lot of oysters out there.
All right, discussion on what Andrew showed us here. I know there's two points I'd like to bring up, and one is blackberry. We've already discussed how that may have been worked too hard last year. We might want to kind of protect that some. And then it's may survey it. What would you do about white shells?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to look at all the areas as much as we can. And I think whatever we go towards October, would sort of have to come off February. I mean, I think keeping the dredge and scrape season to that 4 months, I mean, we can shift it either way. I understand that there's a demand now for oysters. There's going to be higher demand in October. Probably in January and February, that demand might not quite be as high as October, but on the harvester side of things, there's not going to be crabs, there's not going to be spot, there's not going to be really anything. Maybe a few people conch dredging and conch potting, but I think that many of the harvesters that have spoken to me have been more in favor of going towards February than October. But that's something, I think, in White Shoals, that sort of 15th and that bushel limit, I think the pressure that saw, I think we could discuss that collectively, but it might be better to kind of leave it lumped into the change. But
I'm sure that you could get this information out to us.
Yeah.
So we could just have it to look at until our next meeting, kind of make some decisions and observations on it before we send something to the commission.
Andrew, one more question. I heard discussion about James River small oyster disappearing. I mean, is there a disconnect between law enforcement? Do we not have enough law enforcement to enforce the cone law in these areas? What's going on?
I would be more comfortable with law enforcement addressing that, but I think they're doing a job out there, but it is a hard area to enforce. I mean, the James River is a very large area, so it is one of those that all these areas are. Enforcement can be a challenge.
But, you know, I mean, it starts with the watermen, too. if it takes next year's crop,
right there.
What are you going to have next year?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we need law enforcement to stop that from taking place. And do we have enough personnel in James River to do that?
Well, I think there is always the need for more law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And we have been sort of historically a small agency, and there used to be more law enforcement officers than there are now. And I know that we have, I believe, 9 offenders coming up at this next commission meeting. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how many of those are oyster violations.
Offenders,
but
for what?
License. I'm not sure all the details of it, but I mean, they are writing small oyster tickets out there. They have to be convicted, then they get the probation revocation, so there is a process to it.
Poll law is the most
mm-hmm.
prevalent case.
I guess it's three, and then it's August.
The tolerance is 10%, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Some, a waterman told me one time, he said, well, for every 1,000 bushels they leave, it's almost 100 small ones leaving.
So it's 4 quarts per bushel, so it does add up.
I would, you know, to that add, I've been a critical of law enforcement at times, but I would like to say that Blackberry Hang, Great Wacomico, Rappahannock last year, we had outstanding law enforcement and the bad actors that we've seen over the years, and I think Rich could attest to this, after 2 or 3 days in Great Wacomico and Blackberry this year, they were gone. And we've probably got some problems in some areas, but we have done a much better job in others for the last 2 to 3 seasons now. The Rappahannock, I've been very impressed with what we've seen there. And I don't think it's intolerable. I would ask JC or Ernie, but I don't think it's intolerable what we see. But
no,
more or less, they've kind of figured out the bad guys, and they stay on top of them.
And you
do.
I got cold 3 times
in a
week.
That's the
time I've
ever
been cold 3 times
in
a week.
I think law enforcement does do an admirable job, and I'm not by any means implying that those small oysters necessarily left in bushel baskets, but it is that had that focused harvest effort there does impact both the small oysters too. So I'm sure a certain percentage of them did leave via bushel basket, but a probably higher percentage were pulled off the rock by the dredging activity. I mean, White Shoals is a pretty skinny little strip of oysters, and if you're doing circles and you get off the rock and just that back and forth does sort of impact those small oysters. So
it takes so long to call bushel new oysters in the James River. It's unbelievable.
And it's struck for
that one is Huntington Park. Took you 45 minutes to call bushel.
It's struck on everything, eh?
Yeah. He knocked everything off and he get off. But I mean, that's what he's supposed to do. And, yeah. But he looked at me when he got done. He said, I'm going to give you a ticket unless you got 15%. I said, what? I had about half a can is what I had. And I didn't like that, to be honest with you. But he said 15%.
Huh.
If the law enforcement, if somebody runs 20%, they start doing something drastic with their license, they'll cut it out.
Uh-huh.
That's what they need to do. There's a person out there who can try and still get a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
There's a person out there who fills up 2 cups. He's not trying.
Something we could consider is those coal laws, but they have been like that for some time. But
okay.
Mr. Chair, do we have an idea of a date for August so we could kind of put it on our calendar? Do you have an idea?
Be up to Andrew. He usually makes a schedule.
I'll have to look. I'll send out a couple different dates there to work with. We'll look at the calendars here and make sure we don't have any conflicts. But I'm thinking at least that second week prior to the 23rd, but after the 8th. So probably.
West Dobbs seemed to me.
Mm-hmm. Probably sometime the week of the 12th or the 19th would be our best bet. I think the commission is 27th, so ideally, I think sometime this week would probably
come down the road. When you say ideally, there you go.
Yes,
that's ideally. Probably
yep.
The 19th off.
Yeah. So sometime
in there.
In there.
Well, I'm right.
Let's go.
Could we get an email of this PowerPoint and include this and, you know, allow us to get a little bit of time to consider it?
Yeah. Is there anything, although I've got some sort of check on the levels of disease, I can work with VIMS there to get sort of some estimates of mortality and what we do survey there. And I can talk to Ryan further on that and sort of get... I mean, it is one thing to see what you see in a dredge, and it's a different thing to talk. And like you said, we want to make the best decision based on the best information.
And I'm not advocating for a two-year change this year. I mean, I think it's too late for that. But my comments are on our strategic thinking. And
yeah, I agree with Mr. Kellum. I think, you know, this is something that we can always work to change and make better. Don't have to do the same thing over and over and over again. And Mr. O'Reilly is also right. You know, we need to get all the best available information we can before we make any kind of decision.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, one thing. Before we have the next meeting, are you going to have an assessment on Blackberry? Are you going to check that?
I can't promise that we will. We'll at least try to get out there. We had intended to resurvey 2 and 4 of the Rappahannock, and kind of jammed up. We're going to try to get that done this week, but I'm hopeful that before the next meeting we'll have an idea in there. We may be able to find time to get out to the Blackberry to look at that. But I suspect
regardless, that, I would say we're a little strong there that we probably need to consider it. Once we get the PowerPoint, everybody think, you know, I'm thinking we need to back off of that a little bit.
Yeah. Is there anything else for me? Ben had something to mention about an upcoming regulatory change, I believe.
I don't think so, but I think we've got our work cut out for us. This is going to be a challenging oyster season with the events that we've had in the last year weather-wise. So, thank you, Mr. Button.
Thank you.
Just real quickly, most of you probably know it, but just in case you don't, we have another aquaculture committee now. It's, I guess, geared more to the private lease side. Anyway, the legislation was passed this year to change some of the fees for oyster grant applications, transfers. It also authorized the commission to come up with a fee for the 10-year renewal on private leases. Every 10 years, the leases can be renewed. There was already a law in the books that said if you don't use your lease, we could take it back. That law was tweaked a little bit, but it also gave us the authorization to create a regulation for a fee. That will be on this month's agenda, that regulation, that proposed brand new regulation about the 10-year renewal. The proposed fee is $150 per lease per 10 years. So whenever you have a lease, if you have a private lease, it comes up for renewal. The effective date will be October the 1st if the commission approves it as proposed. We have not sent the ones out yet that come due in October, the forms. If you have a lease, you get a form to fill out, show what you've done on it. But when we send those out, the explanation in it that when you send it back, you need to send us the fee of $150 and the form. And in the past, we've sort of given people a 30-day grace period. If the form didn't come back or it was inadequate, you didn't produce enough, and you would get a letter saying your lease was terminated, but it wasn't. We would wait 30 days past your termination date, thinking we'd probably hear from you when you got that letter. And we do hear from a lot of people when they get that letter. And they didn't get the form, or they didn't understand it, or they didn't know what they were supposed to put, and we've accepted them. But under this regulation and the change in the law, it'll be clear on the form that you must return the form before your deadline. Period. If you don't, and the deadline passes, the ground's going to be terminated. If you return it and you didn't have enough activity, of course, we're going to let you know that. And in that instance, your termination date may pass while we're talking, but in essence, if you don't send the form back in by the deadline, we're going to terminate your lease, and then your option per law is you have to ask for a hearing before the commission to see if the commission will reinstate your ground. That's going to be controversial because we're going to do it, I'm sure, to somebody, and they're going to be a test case, but I've already turned some people down under the current law. The law's in effect. The law went into effect February 27th. It was considered an emergency upon the governor's signature. I have turned some people down. We're in this transition period, and we had conversation, and we didn't make them have a hearing yet. But once we put this regulation in effect, that's going to be your only option. So there will be some test cases where this is going to come up. But anyway, I just thought y'all might want to know, pass the word. The regulation's available here if you want to look at it, but it will be on the agenda this commission meeting. I anticipate the commission will act on it.
One question. What about if you've got private ground that's been polluted for the last year?
That's a good question, and we've had people that use this, I don't want to call it an excuse, but put that on the form in the past under the old law. And we have opposition has always been having ground in polluted waters is not a valid reason to not produce oysters, okay, to not grow oysters. You don't have to harvest under this law. You just have to show you've attempted to propagate shellfish. That's still the law. Okay. Harvest is good. If you have harvest, you're pretty much home free. But if you made no effort to propagate oysters, you didn't shell it, you didn't seed it, you didn't turn the shell. I mean, put down, and that's the thing, you need to put down everything you've done on the ground now. Don't assume that I'm going to know who you are and that, you know, I'm going to be benevolent. If you don't put down what you did, and it can be any kind of activity, you know, seeding, shelling, growing oysters in cages, growing oysters in floats over your lease. I'll consider all those things as proof of use of the lease. But if I don't have the information, you're going to get turned down. The problem is if you get turned down and terminated, your only option then, I can't reinstate it. You have to ask for a hearing before the commission. The commission might reinstate it if you give them enough data, but once that time passes and you're terminated, that's it. So.
Yeah. It was just brought to my attention last week. Probably everybody over here knows about it except for me. But being at my age, I want to transfer some of the oyster ground to my kids and everything for the future in case something happens to me. And it was brought to my attention that any lease that's over 50 acres, it would be $1,000 for registration to transfer fee, which is considerably higher than what it's always been in the past. And since I've got 22 pieces of oyster ground, it would be like $20,000 for me to transfer over to my kids for the future. I don't know if you guys already know all about this.
So
I just found out about it.
So quickly, the application fee was changed. It used to be $25. It's now $300, $500, and $1,000. And that's based on 0 to 10. I should have my cheat sheet in front of me. But you're right. If it's over 25 acres, it's $1,000 for application, and it's $1,000. The same fees are for transfers.
Well, you know,
and it's per lease. It used to be you could transfer 5 leases at the same time for one transfer fee. That's the way the law is written.
What really bothers me about that, you know, like I'm farm number 7 in the state of Virginia, and I can remember the president saying that he wanted to fix everything so if a farmer had to transfer some of his land, he wouldn't be penalized or wouldn't lose any of that. And to me, that's contrary to what Trump had said.
Well,
okay, I'm just saying.
I'm just telling you, this is what was passed.
Yeah, I hear you.
I fought those fees a little bit internally when they were being, I didn't think they reflected a reality of why would a 26-acre lease cost $1,000 and a 24-acre lease cost $500 to transfer? But that's the law we're dealing with.
Yeah, okay.
And that's what it is. So it is much more expensive now to apply for ground. It's also much more expensive to transfer ground, a lot more expensive than it was. But and it went into effect February 27th because that was all that law was considered emergency. So,
more reason to follow what's going on in Richmond. It's
you can't.
The reason you we really have to do the industry needs to do a better job of following what's going on up there. I mean, that was passed at the General Assembly this past session.
Thank you.
Sorry,
I didn't bring you such bad news.
You might be here all night for that answer.
All right, Andrew, I guess we'll be looking forward to an email from you on our next meeting and maybe a copy of this PowerPoint here so we can review it and study it a little bit until then.
All right. Well, thank you all for your input and advice here tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Motion to adjourn.
Second. All right. Sit down too long.